This is The End User, episode 182 for Thursday, September 25th.
Volte.
Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr.
And Taylor, we decided to switch days here, and we're broadcasting on Wednesday night. So if you're listening on the download, it's likely to be Thursday. We haven't quite set that in stone, so I'm not sure what day we're going to be on in the coming week. But pay attention to Twitter, and we will let you know next time we're doing the broadcast, because we're just kind of experimenting here.
And if you have a preference, let us know at The End User on Twitter or The End User at thedigitalmediazone.com.
So with that, Taylor, I think we should get into our top news. And I'm very excited about our leading item here. And this is called the BlackBerry Passport, which looks like a very interesting device to me.
Right. I remember we were talking about this when it was first announced. It is a very large BlackBerry with a completely square screen. I think the resolution was something like 1440 by 1440.
Yeah, and it's a weird device. The shape of the thing is bizarre. They named it Passport, obviously, because it's roughly the size of a passport, and it's got a very wide squarish screen. And what's cool is they've got the traditional BlackBerry keyboard down at the very bottom of the phone, but it's extremely small. So they only have the three rows, and you know, beginning with QWERTY at the top and ending with spacebar on the bottom, and that seems to be just enough keyboard to use with this device, and the rest of it is touchscreen. I think it's a pretty nice take on a vertical modern smartphone with a keyboard on it. I think it's really cool looking.
Well, it's definitely interesting. It's a form factor that we haven't really seen before, and that keyboard does look really nice. If you are someone who wants a physical keyboard on your smartphone above all else, this is really going to appeal to you. But honestly, as a BlackBerry in the third quarter of 2014, I thought that we would never see this device on the market.
Yeah, you know, BlackBerry has been in kind of a tailspin, as it were, and you know, they've tried to come out with a bunch of Halo devices that would save them, and they really haven't been able to do that. Now, I don't see this being that device either. I don't see this kind of stemming the bleeding, as it were. It's just, I like the form factor of this hardware. I just kind of wish it ran Android.
Right. Well, one thing that they did add to their new software, that's BlackBerry OS 10.3, is that it works with the large majority of Amazon's App Store.
Oh, yeah. And that's just kind of bizarre, right? Having to run Amazon's apps, that's really strange. You know, this is the kind of pressure that Google exerts on the Android ecosystem, is that you don't get access to the Play Store proper unless Google blesses the product. And I'm guessing Google didn't. And but they have some compatibility with Android in some way, and they have some compatibility with these with Amazon apps, which is just kind of bizarre.
Yeah, it is a little bizarre, but you know, it's cool. It's definitely going to be a larger selection of apps than BlackBerry users are used to.
Yeah, very true. And you know, you look at this device, you look at the software there, and they have the technical capability to run Android apps, but Google won't let them in the Play Store. And you look at the Windows Phone marketplace, and I wonder who has more apps, the Windows Phone store or the Amazon store? And I would bet it would be the Amazon store, as weird as that is.
No, I think that's probably true as well. There's not a whole lot of barriers for Android developers to put their apps on the Amazon store. So there are going to be a lot of Android apps that people put on the Amazon store just for a greater share of the market.
Yeah, and it looks like to me that the developers will have to make some kind of tweak to the app to make it run on BlackBerry. So there, it seems to be some kind of subset of apps that you can get. So I'm not quite sure how many and which ones that will be, but it's kind of cool that it can do it in the first place. And the one thing that's weird, though, is that if you just strap Android apps onto this device, it's not really going to be an app that's designed for this device. And I don't know if the user experience could possibly be as good as if you were on a regular Android phone.
Yeah, not to mention that square screen is probably not something that a lot of Android developers program to accommodate.
Yeah, very true. Well, so the Recode article we're sharing in the show notes, Bonnie Cha says that she was able to run Twitter and Facebook, and they scaled okay, and she was able to run Netflix and Fitbit and a few others. So that's a very interesting feature, although, again, from a user experience perspective, I'm not sure of that. But
well, the main thing is going to be the keyboard here, and yes, the fact that it has Android apps are a bonus. But if you wanted Android apps, you'd buy an Android phone. If you want the keyboard, this looks like the phone to get right now.
Yeah, I really like the hardware. I think that it's a really competent shot at how to get a smartphone with a keyboard in a modern phone. I think that is a really, really good idea. And I could see this being some kind of work phone, right? I mean, if work gave me this phone, I wouldn't be that upset about it.
Because, oh, yeah, absolutely.
I wouldn't be doing Netflix on it or anything like that. I would just be using the keyboard, and yet it would still be a kind of modern experience. So I think that's really cool.
Right. You don't want to watch video. You probably don't want to play too many games on this phone. But it is great for productivity, and I think that was what they were going for.
Yeah. So at very least, and very interesting... a very interesting device in a smartphone market that is already very mature. And I think this is, I'm not calling this out for absolute success in saving BlackBerry, but it is at very least kind of technically interesting from the form factor that it's coming from. So very cool. Very cool to see.
All right. Well, another new phone that is technically interesting and we really like the hardware on is the Samsung Galaxy Alpha. We've talked about this phone before. It kind of looks like an iPhone 5. It's got an aluminum body with chamfered polished edges. It comes in a variety of colors, but it's all aluminum on the back. And it's got a 4.7-inch display with a 12-megapixel camera, 2 gigs of RAM, quad-core processor. And it's coming to AT&T on September 26th.
Yeah, and this is a modern Android phone. This is what we expect now. This is the new kind of generation of modern Android phones. So that's cool. So also, it's 4.7 inches. So it's the size of the iPhone 6.
Right, so this would be considered a little bit of a smaller phone these days.
Right.
I guess, this is a little more slick and pocketable than the Galaxy S5, which I think is up to 5.1 inches or something now.
Yeah, so other than that, there's not a lot to mention other than the fact that it's available quite soon. In fact, by the time you hear this, it may be available by then. And, we talked about the hardware some time ago, so we can skip that bit of discussion. So let's move on into some interesting announcements from Amazon. They've revealed some new tablet and e-readers.
Yeah, they basically revamped their whole,
the whole thing.
Kindle line. So starting at the bottom, they have replaced their $69 entry-level Kindle with a $79 version that will now have a touchscreen, a faster processor, which is great for the e-paper refresh, and double the memory. So that's $79. The Kindle Paperwhite, their flagship product, is $119 and has got similar upgrades. And they've introduced a new high-end e-paper Kindle called the Voyage.
Yeah, and this looks like a pretty, you know, it's hard to upgrade the Kindle because it's such a basic device. They've almost nailed it at this point. But
yeah, pretty much. They're very small, very thin and light, and the battery lasts forever. So the new one has it's even thick. It's even thinner. It has a very high resolution display, so it's 300 pixels per inch, which makes it a more book-like reading experience. And they claim that the contrast is 39% brighter. And then it has a front-lit screen, just like the Paperwhite, that is supposedly easier to read in low-light environments. But then this one will automatically adjust to the ambient light in the room.
Yeah, and I feel like that, I don't know about that feature. That may be a gimmick, but they have absolutely incrementally improved this thing in a way that does make it better. The other thing I noticed just from looking at the shots that Ars Technica took is I can see on the Paperwhite screen the glare of the light bouncing off the screen, and you can't see it on the Voyage. So that's really encouraging. You know, the more they can decrease the glare off of the plastic of the screen, the better it's going to be. And, you know, again, they made it just kind of faster and thinner, and I think it's a nice iterative touch. Now, one thing that's kind of cool is that they now have these little paddles on the side that you can touch to change the page instead of actually turning the page. So that's kind of a nice feature. You know, on the Paperwhite, you either touch the right side of the screen or you swipe from right to left to turn the page. And with this, there's a little optional paddle on the side that you can touch. And apparently you only have to touch it just a little bit to get the page to turn. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I like that. It makes it a little bit easier to use one-handed.
Yes, absolutely. And the other thing that I think is relatively big, again, considering the iterative nature of the Kindle upgrades, is that the screen is now flush with the bezel. So there's no indent to reach down into. It's all just kind of a one material slate across the front of the device. So, you know, you've got the black bezel and you've got the e-ink screen, and it's flush. So I think that's pretty nice too.
So it's a little bit more like a tablet screen or an iPad,
right?
Or something.
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of tablets, Amazon updated their Kindle Fire line as well. So they've got two versions of the regular Kindle Fire HD at 6 and 7 inches.
That's almost like a phone these days.
Yeah, it's pretty much. Although the Kindle Fire phone is a little bit smaller than that, and probably has a couple more features. But then they've also updated the Fire HDX, and that's 8.9 inches. And supposedly this is a great new tablet here, and they've introduced a keyboard to go with it.
Yeah, and the keyboard reminds me a little bit of the Surface keyboard, but just kind of more miniature, a little smaller. But yeah, I think we're still kind of figuring out where all of these devices belong and, you know, kind of when we need a keyboard and when we don't. And it's kind of a bizarre world in computing because you can really get away without a real computer and use one of these things. And I bet you a lot of people have. So the new display on the HDX is 2560 by 1600, and that's almost 340 PPI. So it's a pretty good looking screen, I'd imagine.
Oh yeah, I absolutely bet it is. The smaller Kindle Fire HDs are 1280 by 800, but at 6 inches, that's not too bad. And that one is $99. The 7-inch model is $139, and the 8.9-inch HDX starts at $379.
Yeah, and I'd imagine they lose money on these devices and make it up in Amazon services when they sell you things with the phone and with the tablet. So I guess you have to keep that in mind. But again, we're looking at their customized version of Android called Fire OS, and they have the 4.4 KitKat at this point in time. And I look at it and everybody seems to think that it's great for Amazon people, but then I never actually hear the Amazon people speak up and say, yes, this is my device. I love this. So I'm still unsure of not having the Google Play Market and having the Amazon App Store on these devices. I just feel like it's not something I can really recommend.
Well, I know a few people who have some of these devices, the older Kindle Fires, and certainly there are lots of people around with e-paper Kindles, and they seem pretty good. It's hard to compare them to something like a Surface or an iPad.
Yeah, true.
But there are certain Android devices that you could compare it to pretty favorably.
Yeah, well, the e-ink Kindles are a different story. I think they stand on their own just fine, and Amazon's ebook ecosystem is fantastic. But I'm just not sure of these Android devices with the Amazon store. I'm kind of down on them. But I'm probably selling them short. I bet you they actually sell a ton of them. And I guess people just maybe don't talk about them as much as the flagship Android tablets and iPads and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the Kindle Fires especially, they are tablets that just sort of work. You know, when you tie them into the Amazon ecosystem, and there's not a whole lot to write home about, but it works fine. And so people get these things, and that's their tablet, and maybe their kids use them, or they use them for trips or reading or casual web browsing, and that's what a lot of people are looking for. That works great, and it's a cheap device that does what you need it to.
Yeah, so I think I'm selling it short a little bit for sure. All right, well, should we move away from our top news, get seated, fasten your seatbelt, and move into the afterburners?
Sure. All right, seatbelt's ready. Let's kick on the afterburners.
Okay, one last bit of Amazon news. They're bringing the unlimited book subscription to the UK now. So that launched 2 months ago in the US, and it's going to be around £8 a month for this unlimited book subscription service. So that's kind of cool.
So AT&T may be looking to buy DirecTV, but they are also offering a new deal for their terrestrial internet subscribers. It's the cord cutter package, and for $40 a month, they are offering terrestrial internet subscribers broadband internet, plus 1 year of Amazon Prime and HBO, along with a smattering of basic cable channels. So basically, you're not paying for the full package of cable. You're just getting the things that you want, which I guess are internet, Amazon Prime, and HBO.
Yeah, it's basically HBO plus all of the local channels, plus Prime, and it's $40 a month. I think that's great.
Yeah, it's great if you happen to live in an area where AT&T offers landline internet. And if you really want to cut the cable and you have a PlayStation 4, starting October 19th in the U.S., you can get the $99 PlayStation TV accessory. So it doubles as a PlayStation Vita system, and it works in conjunction with the PlayStation 4, can download Vita games and other titles sold on the PlayStation Network. And it can stream to and from a PlayStation 4 with remote play, and allows you to get Vita video apps like Netflix and Hulu Plus.
Cool. So it's almost like a TiVo Mini kind of deal, but for PlayStation. So that seems like a pretty cool option. So Microsoft has released its Miracast streaming dongle. So this is a little HDMI port. A little HDMI stick that you can plug into the back of your TV, almost like a Chromecast competitor, but it's kind of built on the Miracast standard, which is open and just about anyone can use. And it looks pretty cool, but it's just really, really expensive. It's $60 for this little stick, and that is a really hefty price to pay for something that does so little.
Yeah, it cuts a cord. So you're cutting your cable cord, and then you're cutting your PlayStation cord, and then you're cutting your HDMI cord.
You're cutting
cord.
HDMI, yeah.
Yeah, so it's all the cords are cut today. I think it's a pretty nifty little device. But you have to have wireless display through Miracast,
right?
In order to use this, right?
Yes, yes. So you have to have a device that supports this to use it. So I believe the Surface, amongst many other devices, support this. So again, it's nice to see it, but it's just so expensive for what you get. So the end user PSA of the week, Home Depot, has been hacked. They managed to get some malware on their point of sale system. So they're saying that around 56 million credit cards are at risk. And the skinny is that the company chose not to activate some security features that were in place to prevent malware, like the kind of malware that got in. So they are having to eat crow at this. And if you had been shopping at Home Depot recently, you probably want to change that card around.
Yikes. So yeah, this was potentially any Home Depot in the U.S. or Canada,
right?
Between April and September.
Yeah, so it's been all over mainstream media as well. So you probably have already heard of this and taken action if you needed to take action. But I figured we'd mention it here in the Afterburners as well.
Wow, okay. So Google is no longer requiring you to have Google Plus in order to sign up for Gmail.
Woohoo!
So they were heavily tying in Google Plus to all of their free services, and now they are scaling that back. So Google Plus isn't going anywhere. It's just slightly more optional now.
Taylor, I believe, and I don't have any data to back this up, but I believe that this is the beginning of the great back down of Google Plus. And we will look back and say, what was Google Plus, and why were all my Google accounts tied to Google Plus?
But how will I hang out, Chris? What will we use instead?
We'll use Hangouts.
Don't I need Google Plus for Hangouts?
Well, yeah, you still do for the moment. But I predict that this is going to launch a larger trend in Google land, where you don't have to use Google Plus for everything. So we'll see. We'll see in months and years from now what actually happens.
I suppose we will. Good news for Verizon users who have the new iPhone 6 or 6 Plus, along with the HTC One and maybe one or two other phones. They have launched officially Voice over LTE. So this allows you to, for one thing, talk and use data at the same time on your Verizon phone, which you never could do before, unless you were on Wi-Fi. And also have a much higher call quality when you're calling over their network.
And by saying much higher, it's like hugely higher.
It's
a gigantic leap in call quality if one cares about that. So I haven't heard anybody say the acronym for this, so I'm going to take a shot at it and call it VOLTE. That's Voice over LTE. V-O, capital V, lower O, capital L, capital T, capital E. That's VOLTE.
I prefer a Volte.
Volte. Well, you'd have to have an accent on it. All right, well, let's turn off the Afterburners and let's get into the end user stories. We've got some iPhone follow-up for starting the end user stories, and let's get into that.
Yes, so we already mentioned the Verizon iPhone story, but last week we reported on the announcement of the new iPhones, but now they're out and people have started playing with them and reviewing them and discovering some things about them that Apple either didn't think of or didn't think to tell us when they first announced it. So the first bit of news here is that, as usual, iFixit.com, the tech website devoted to repairability, flew, as they have started doing for every Apple product release. They flew to Australia so that they could be the first in line to pick one up and immediately start taking it apart and putting pictures on the internet. So what they discovered is that both the iPhone 6 and the 6 Plus are more repairable than the iPhone 5S. They got the same rating, a 7, as the iPhone 5, and that's because they changed a couple of the cables inside the phone to make it easier to open than the 5S. And basically, there was no reason for Apple to do this except to make it easier to open and repair. They also found that the batteries inside these devices are enormous. And there's a couple of other technological tidbits, including some details about the new A8 processor. But you can read the Ars Technica article or just head over to iFixit.com to see the details on that.
And I feel like they are able to do some of that because, and this is just speculation, but because they have more space vertically and because the phones are just larger, I feel like they can make some size compromise in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even though it's a thinner device, there is a lot more volume inside the phone to be had and stuffed with components. Now, one of those new components is NFC, and that's the near-field communication technology that Android phones have had for years and that Apple will be using to power its Apple Pay service. Now, last week, I reported that I was really excited on the inclusion of NFC in the new iPhones. To see what else developers could be doing with NFC. But it turns out Apple wants to lock that down for now and make it so that no one can reverse engineer Apple Pay, at least not with any help from Apple. So they are not offering any software development kits for NFC. It's only going to be used for Apple Pay as it is right now.
Right. Now, I bet you at some point in the future they will flip a switch and have developers have access to that hardware, but I guess just not now. But I'd have to imagine that sometime in the future, they will flip on the access to that hardware, and they just haven't done it yet. And they haven't. They probably just launched the phone and didn't have time to get to that, and they turned it off. I'd have to imagine that they're going to come back and reevaluate that at some point in time. I don't know when, though.
Yeah, I'm sure that they will. I predict iOS 10.
Okay, iOS 10 it is. I will mark the calendar, and we will come back and see in a couple years.
All right, so another new feature that they are enabling via software is iCloud Drive, and that's the ability to store any documents, not just files related to specific iPhone apps, on iCloud. And so you can access it from your computer if you have OS 10.10 Yosemite, which is only in beta right now, but you can also access it now through the new iCloud for Windows update. So if you are a Windows and iOS user, you have more functionality in iCloud than you would if you were a regular Mac user, unless you're on the Yosemite beta. What you have to do when you install iOS 8 is you have to manually switch it over from the old iCloud to the new iCloud, and it'll ask you if you want to do that. If you use iCloud between your Mac and your iPhone, don't enable iCloud Drive yet. Wait until you have Yosemite and iOS 8 installed on all of your devices. But if you're a Windows user, go ahead and flip that switch and then install iCloud Drive on your PC.
Cats and dogs living together, Taylor. So this will enable some developers to move away from storing stuff in Dropbox, I'd imagine. So that seems to be the current best way to sync stuff between iOS and other places. You know, like settings and stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty great. I mean, all of that, all of the settings and all the application files will generally sync automatically. iCloud Drive is going to be a Dropbox replacement. So it's, if you already are using iCloud and maybe you're already paying for some extra storage using their new very cheap storage plans, it may be a better deal for you to use iCloud Drive than Dropbox or Box.net or SkyDrive or what have you. But it sort of depends on what you're using already and how much you're paying for it.
Yeah, very true. So, woe is me in Apple land. What's going on with HealthKit and the 8.0.1 update? It seems to be not working for some people.
Right. Well, HealthKit is one of the marquee features of iOS 8, and it gives you access to all sorts of health data and supposedly allows you to share more information between doctors and keep track of everything, but most of it isn't really ready. The only thing that Apple has fully enabled is the medical ID program, and developers don't have access to it, so there's not a whole lot you can do with it. So Apple is saying that HealthKit app support will be available at the end of September. But in the meantime, Apple released iOS 8.0.1, which was their immediate update to the iOS 8 release for everything from the iPad 2 and the iPhone 4S on up. But they pulled that update because there were apparently some problems with the iPhone 6. The rest of the phones seemed to handle the update fine. But I'm sure that they will be re-releasing a new version in the next few days, possibly by the time you're listening to this.
Yeah, so they apparently people were having problems with really, really basic features on their phones, so a bit of a black eye there for Apple, but they'll come back, they'll fix it, they'll release a real update and release it, so just give it some time.
Yeah, so I'm sure that they will release that soon enough. And in the meantime, I haven't had any trouble with the initial release of iOS 8. I have it on my iPhone and my iPad now, and it's seems to be working just fine. So I'm glad that I didn't try to download that update. Now, another feature that Apple has added to their iCloud services is two-factor authentication. It now protects your entire iCloud account, including your backups.
So they didn't previously,
and that to some of the security breaches that they discovered in iCloud a few months ago. But they now have two-factor authentication is pretty much covering the entirety of your web-enabled data on your iPhone or iPad.
Yeah, cool. So there was a kind of oversight that happened that allowed a bunch of people's data to get out into the wild, and we talked about it on the show, of course, and now they've basically fixed it, so that's good to see moving forward.
Yeah, it is. Now, Apple has gone beyond that with iOS 8, increasing security from a system architecture perspective. So now Apple basically does not have direct search access to any of the iCloud data that you store or any of the data that's on your phone. So they have released an updated security guide that outlines the 256-bit encryption key that basically protects anyone from snooping on your data at the server side. So the main difference here is that if law enforcement officials serve Apple a warrant to access some user's data from their servers, they will no longer be able to do so, technically speaking.
Yeah, and there's it's still a little bit hazy to me what exactly is covered under this, because I think there was some data that wasn't covered and there was some data that was, but it's they explicitly did this to prevent anyone from asking them to hand over that kind of data, and now they just cannot do it.
Yep, that's absolutely right.
So one last potential negative Apple story here. The iPhone 6 is bendable? I didn't know that.
Well, it is a large, very thin slab of aluminum, so it makes sense that it would be able to be bent, but a lot of iPhone 6 Plus owners are noticing slight bending just from regular use. So the screens aren't cracking in most of these cases, fortunately, although several people have cracked their front screens by trying to bend it back. But when you place the phone screen down on a flat surface, you can sometimes detect a little bit of rocking, which implies that the body has become bent. And people are saying that this is just coming from sitting and standing with the phone in their front pocket.
Yeah, that seems a little strange. There's a video of a person forcefully bending the phone in some direction, and he has success in bending the phone. And the same person has done the same thing with a ton of other phones. So it's not just the iPhone that is bendable. I mean, this stuff is metal, ultimately, and you really can do that to these devices. Now, if it's coming from normal wear and tear on the phone, that's really not a good thing. But we have to kind of wait and see how this shakes out, because I'm not sure. I'm not sure, you know, exactly how widespread this is, or is it just one person who has really tight jeans and fits and sits strangely? You know, I don't know. So we don't quite know yet, but we do know that basically any phone out there is going to be bendable in a similar kind of manner, at least.
Yeah, particular ones where the frame is made of aluminum. Obviously, plastic is even more malleable than aluminum, but plastic will more easily return to its original shape. Any phone made with stainless steel and glass, like the iPhone 4 and 4S, those are pretty unlikely to bend under normal use. But, you know, the good news is the iPhone 6 and the 6 Plus especially, they are able to take a little bit of bending, and there are no other adverse effects on these bent phones, except for the cases where they've been purposefully bent to an extreme.
Yeah, so there are people out there calling this a huge scandal, and I don't think I'm ready to say that this is something like AntennaGate.
Oh, have you not heard the new phrase? Slate.com has coined the phrase Benghazi.
Oh, no.
Yes. Oh, no is right.
That is not good.
So should we call it Benghazi Gate?
No, we can just call it Ben Gate. And hopefully we can call it nothing. That's what I'm really hoping for, is that it was just a couple isolated incidents, and that it's not really a reality for most iPhone users. That's what I'm hoping for.
I'm hoping for that too, because I still want to get one of these, and I would like for it to not bend.
See, Apple should have just come up on stage and say, look, we figured this bending thing out. And the iPhone 6, yeah, the iPhone 6 has the ability to bend without breaking the screen. So if you sit down strangely in really tight pants, the phone will in fact not break. It will give under pressure.
It's a feature, not a bug.
It is a feature, not a bug. That's right. So I don't know. We'll see. This is just kind of breaking today, so we'll see how true this is for most people. I have the feeling that it's going to be a little smaller than people seem to think it is going to be today. So hopefully that's the case, and I guess we'll come back to it at some point on the podcast later, and we'll see what happens with that.
All right. Well, that just about wraps up our iPhone coverage for this week. We've got one more tip of the week coming up. But first, Chris, I think that you wanted to talk about some other non-iPhone related stories.
Yeah, I've got a couple things going on, particularly in my home theater around here. So I figured I'd mention them and see what you thought. So first off, I started playing a game on Windows Phone called Age of Empires: Castle Siege in a nostalgic attempt to get back to the golden days of Age of Empires 2. And I've come away from this game it's on Windows Phone and Windows 8, largely disappointed. It's really only related to Age of Empires in that it is called Age of Empires and that you pick civilizations and that you build things. It's more like the Clash of Clans game for iOS, where you have this persistent world out there that you get to check in on every once in a while. And when you launch the game, you check in on the world and you build things. And the things start to build, and you close the app, and you come back 2 hours later, and the thing has been built. And then, you know, you wage battles and stuff like that. So it's kind of cool. It's a little disappointing. I was hoping for something a little more true to the original form, but I think it is well executed in that. but it just wasn't what I was expecting to get.
Well, that's too bad. I mean, is it still fun?
Yeah, no, it's still pretty fun. I think it's still a pretty good game. They had some issues with the Windows Phone client that that caused some crashing in the early release, but it looks like they've fixed that for the moment. And yeah, the game is in fact fun. It's just it's kind of a ripoff of the Clash of Clans game. So, you know, I'd rather just play Clash of Clans if that was the case.
Well, I would rather not. I don't like that game at all. I think it's ridiculous.
Really? Well, maybe you'd like the spin that Microsoft put on it.
Maybe I would. I don't know. I do like tower defense games.
Yeah, because is it the... what exactly is it that you don't like about Clash of Clans?
It's too complicated.
Yeah, it is pretty complicated. This is also pretty complicated, but you know, I was kind of expecting that bit out of the game. So I haven't tried the Windows 8 version, so maybe I've got some homework to do on that. And I think I'll continue to play it, even though I'm slightly disappointed by it. I came into it not knowing exactly what it was going to be, and I was a little surprised at what it was. So I'm still kind of getting into it. I'm still learning things about it. It is also very complicated. And they take the same business model where you can basically you can do whatever you want if you want to pay money and buy gold, and you just have to wait longer if you don't want to do that. So honestly, that's kind of irritating. You know, I'm not gonna pump any actual dollars into the purchasing of gold, but it's still pretty fun. We'll see how it goes. I don't know. We'll see how long I stick with it.
All right, cool. Good review.
All right, well, I've also made some upgrades in my home theater. Actually, as a wedding gift, oddly enough, I had the Energy Take Classic 5.1 surround system on there. And in anticipation of either buying it myself or getting it from the wedding registry that we were on recently here, I got a Denon AVR 1513, which is basically the bargain basement bottom line DVR that you could AVR that you could possibly get. So, anyway, I got the speakers all hooked up, and I ditched my old Blu-ray home theater in a box 5.1 surround system. And Taylor, the difference is stunning.
Oh yeah,
yeah. The Energy Take is kind of the lowest possible 5.1 that you could get that works with a receiver. And it is just miles and miles ahead of the old home theater in a box system. It sounds really great.
Yeah, I did have a chance to hear it, and I could hear certain things. I think we were watching a football game,
yeah,
and I could hear details of the crowd that I just was not picking up from your old system.
Yeah, so it just sounds more full. The sound is a lot more subtle. There's a lot more detail that you can hear in it. And the old system was just kind of, you know, it seems like it was blurry to me. It sounded blurry, if that makes any sense.
You've got corrective lenses for your home theater.
Yeah, I need special earpieces to deal with that. Maybe somebody sells those. So
I doubt it.
So, in introducing another piece of equipment into the home theater that requires another remote, I was talking to some people on Twitter who are in the community, and I decided to go out and get a Harmony smart remote. So this is a infrared blaster hub that has a simple remote that talks to the hub over some kind of wireless protocol. And largely, I think it's pretty good. I'm still ironing out some issues with the receiver, and the receiver is not getting the correct aspect ratio. So sometimes I have to just kind of reset it. And so I haven't quite figured that out. And it happens intermittently, so I'm not exactly sure when that happens. So I'm still kind of figuring that out. But by and large, I think it's a pretty nice device, and it really knocks us down to two remotes, that being the smart remote and the wireless keyboard that we have, you know, for home theater PC kind of activities. But It's neat. So you can program any single button that you want. For example, they had on long press, it would skip forward 30 seconds. And I wanted that to be on short press. So I just reversed it. And it worked out pretty well, I think.
Great. Yeah, you definitely want the short press to control the jump forward.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
That is ideal. You can't do the long press. It messes up the whole flow.
Yeah, I thought that was backwards. So, and I had to figure out where to map the green button for Media Center. So the green button in Media Center takes you to the home screen, basically. And I mapped it to the exit button. It seemed like an arbitrary choice, but that's what I ended up doing. So I think it's working pretty well. Again, I got to iron out the issues that have come up. And I'll probably get to that this weekend is my guess.
Okay, so the Harmony Smart Remote, the Energy Take Classic 5.1 and the Denon 1513. Is that like a good package upgrade that you'd recommend to people trying to spruce up their home entertainment system?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's really all on the low end of the market. And I think it's what I've got now is kind of the bare minimum that you need to build on top of. You know, the old Blu-ray home theater in a box system was way cheaper than all of this stuff, but with the Energy Take speakers and the real receiver, I can now replace the center channel with an upgraded center channel and that kind of thing. So as far as kind of a starter system, it seems pretty nice to me.
Well, so this isn't quite a starter system. You already had a surround sound system with Blu-ray that was cheaper than this one. But this is sort of the low end of the high end, right? It's the starter system for advanced systems.
Well, and the problem with the home theater in a box stuff is that you can't take speakers from a normal surround sound system and put them onto the Blu-ray player, or at least the one that I had. They had an impedance mismatch that would burn out the receiver. So I couldn't even take those speakers and use them for anything. I couldn't take the Samsung Blu-ray speakers and put them on the Denon receiver. This is the first level of a modular system where you can swap stuff in and out. So hopefully, you know, I'll probably be making some upgrades over the coming years, but I think this is a pretty good base to start with.
Yeah, it sounds pretty great. I mean, literally, it sounded great when I was there.
Yeah, you got to come over and watch Life and Planet Earth and that kind of thing.
Oh, can we watch The Matrix?
On Blu-ray, yeah. I'd have to buy The Matrix on Blu-ray, but sure. All right, well, let's get out of my home theater for a minute, and let's talk about some green tech. It's a different kind of take on energy.
Yes, it is a little bit different this time. So this week I want to talk about hydrogen. And now hydrogen is not really a source of energy, not really clean or unclean energy. It's sort of a energy storage form. Think of hydrogen as a gaseous battery that you can use to run hydrogen fuel cells, which are powerful enough to run an entire car or whatever, really. It's very powerful, extensible, simple technology. But the trick is getting hydrogen. Now, we don't have a lot of free hydrogen floating around on this planet, so you could go to a different planet and pick some up, but that's pretty expensive. So we like
a ton of hydrogen in the sun.
Yeah, good luck getting any of that.
Of course, it's already providing us with energy, so
yeah,
a little different.
So the trick is, how do you get hydrogen here on Earth? And there are three main problems with getting hydrogen. One is that you have to use energy to get it. You can only get so efficient converting energy into hydrogen and then converting that back into energy. And it tends to be, depending on the process you use, around 50% to 70%. But the problem with that is, where do you get that energy? So it's green if, you know, it's clean energy if the energy you're using to make the hydrogen is clean, and it's dirty if you are using non-renewable energy sources to get the energy to make the hydrogen. The third problem is that hydrogen can be dangerous. The easiest way to produce hydrogen that we have right now is to use electrolysis of water, which splits water, H2O, into two hydrogen molecules and one oxygen molecule. Now, although they are very stable when they're together, when you separate them, hydrogen is highly combustible, and oxygen is the catalyst for combustion. So when you have both of those together, you have a potentially unstable element. So the question is, how do you separate those during the electrolysis process? And the news here this week is that researchers have developed a system that largely separates the two gases as you put the water through electrolysis. So it's kind of technical, and you can read the write-up from Ars Technica about how it works. But basically, you just use a catalyst that grabs the hydrogen protons and keeps them liquid while the oxygen floats to the top and becomes gaseous. And then you just transfer the oxygen somewhere and remove the catalyst, and then you have the hydrogen left over.
Yeah, cool. Well, and like you said, if you want the real, you know, science behind it, we've got a link in the show notes over to Ars Technica, and they've got a link over to the actual paper, I believe. So, yeah, if you're really interested in the nitty-gritty details, then you can head over to the show notes. So,
right. So the advantage to that would be a cheaper, less dangerous way of creating hydrogen that you could do using clean energy that would essentially create battery power with a much lower overall waste footprint than the lithium and lead acid based batteries that we're using today.
Well, and also part of it is going to be we're looking toward hydrogen because of the energy density of that, right?
So, oh yeah, absolutely.
The potentially, at least, and this is where it always falls apart, is we have research that tell us that hydrogen is going to be the fuel of the future, and then there's some kind of deal-killing complication that comes in when they try to make a real engineered solution to using hydrogen as a storage mechanism.
Well, the storage mechanisms, they are working just fine. It's really the creation of large amounts of hydrogen that's the problem. It's expensive and difficult and hard to control, but storing it in tanks or cars, it's not really a huge problem. It's the generation of it that doesn't really work out
scale. Yeah, so that's cool. It's cool to hear though that we've got some kind of breakthrough there. It's good stuff.
Yep.
All right, well, let's get on into the tip of the week as we round out the show. And I've got us covered, oddly enough, with an iPhone tip of the week. So it turns out that, according to Mac Rumors here, you can use the iPad power adapter that is 2.1 amps, and it will, in fact, charge your iPhone more quickly. So I thought that was kind of an interesting little note. They've got some in the post we're sharing here. They've got some readouts from a kilowatt, which is just a little device that measures the wattage of stuff that you plug into it. And it's kind of cool to note that if you have one of these higher amperage converters, then you can charge your device a little more quickly.
Yeah, so they're saying as little as 2 hours for the iPhone 6 Plus, and that is a really big battery, so 2 hours is very impressive. Now, the problem is that you still get the low wattage 5-watt, 1-amp charger with the new iPhones. So you need to find a charger separately if you want to charge them quickly, like we're talking about. And like this article mentions. So one way to do it is if you have a full-sized iPad charger that provides 2.1 amps at 10 to 12 watts and will charge an iPhone more quickly. Another way you can do it is to plug into a Mac running Mavericks or Yosemite from, I think, 2012 or later. They have dynamic USB ports that can ramp up the charging current to qualified devices with like the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus.
Yeah, and I do wonder if using this charger with the iPhone will somehow decrease the life of the battery or something like that. There's got to be some trade-off for this. So I'm not sure I would recommend doing this every night and regularly, but it is at least good to know that you can do it.
I do it every night, and I have not seen a huge problem.
Okay.
So I charge both my iPad and my iPhone regularly from the iPad charger, the 12-watt charger. And I only have the iPhone 5. It's still charging at 5 watts, and it's not pulling the full 2.1
right.
amps, but
yeah.
It still does charge a lot faster on the bigger charger than the smaller one.
Interesting. So yeah, mix and match the parts a little bit, and maybe you can get a charge a little faster. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and if you don't have the iPad or you don't want to charge it on your brand new computer, or you don't have one of those either, you can go out and buy the Apple iPad charger for, I think, $19. It comes with a lightning cable, and it'll let you charge your phone faster.
Cool. So let's move on into the app pick of the week, and you've got us covered here. What do you got for us?
Right. So a few weeks ago, Google came out with, or they added an ability to Chrome OS to allow it to run certain Android apps called App Runtime for Chrome. So you had to be running a Chromebook, basically, and then you could only run certain Android apps. So this week, a developer who goes by the name Vladikov, released a hack from App Runtime for Chrome called Archon, that uses that Chrome software to run any Android app on any instance of Chrome, that is on OS X, Windows, or Linux.
Cool. So I know we've seen something similar to this with, what was that app that allowed you to run Android apps on Windows? It was called Blue something or other?
I don't remember, but so this one will sort of work directly through Chrome.
Right. So that was BlueStax was the application that allowed you to do that. So that's kind of cool that he was able to take the code and adapt it. That's neat. More choices
yes.
is always good for the end user.
So, yep, that's it. It is obviously unsupported by Google.
Yes.
Use it at your
yeah.
own risk. But if you want to run Android apps on your computer, this is a pretty easy way to do it.
All right, and with that, let's move into our kicker, and we are going to Mars this week, twice. So what's going on with our friendly robots of the solar system?
All right, well, the first big news is that India's Mars orbiter mission, the Mangalyaan, entered orbit very recently around Mars. So they managed to build, launch, and successfully enter orbit a spacecraft that costs less than your average Hollywood movie.
Yeah, the thing I saw getting thrown around on Twitter was that the cost of this was less than the movie Gravity, right?
Right, which didn't even actually go to space.
Right. So that's cool. So they're saying that this device cost them $72 million, and the MAVEN project for the United States costs $671. So if you're talking about efficiency of engineering, then they have definitely achieved that.
Yeah, absolutely. The NASA version was a little bit more expensive, and they both reached Mars around the same time. NASA's MAVEN mission entered orbit on September 21st. And they both have essentially the same mission, and that is to analyze the planet and its atmosphere from orbit and look for more signs of potential life.
Yeah, so that's really neat that we now have We now have rovers on the planet. We've got multiple stable orbiting satellites around it now, and we're really going to start being in a place where we have a lot of data about this planet.
Yeah, I feel like we have been collecting a lot of data for the last 10 years, and this will certainly only accelerate that process.
Yeah, so that's really neat to see. All right, well, I think that will do it for this week. Taylor, if somebody wanted to contact you on the internet somehow, how would they go about doing that?
Snapchat.
Okay. What's your Snapchat handle?
Are there handles on Snapchat? I don't think that's how it works.
I'm not sure. I don't use Snapchat. The other week I said I was going to try it, and then I never did. Maybe I should do that.
All right. Well, if you're going to Snapchat with me, you could always ask for my handle on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @TaylorPhone.
All right. And if you want to get at me, I am @ChrisHaleBarnes.
And definitely Snapchat with Chris.
Yes. Or at least once I sign up for it and get the unofficial Windows Phone app.
Which I assume you're doing right now.
Yes, I will do it right after the show, or right after I publish the show. How about that?
I'm just teasing you.
All right, so let's get out of here. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under The End User. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0 and Home On. You can send us some feedback. We've got an email. It's theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter. Together, we are @TheEndUser. Join us in the chat room as we record the show live every someday. I'm not sure when. We'll announce that on Twitter sometime soon and see how that works out. But we will be at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, no matter what that day ends up being. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime Taylor Marr.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.